First, we take our look at the week in Washington. The White House is trying to block the release of a book by former National Security Advisor John Bolton. A show of force by North Korea this week sets back relations with the U.S. and South Korea. And after the president's executive order yesterday, Senate Republicans still plan to vote on their own police reform package. House Democrats passed their own version last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the different police reform ideas put forth by the president, Republicans, and Democrats? Should things like a chokehold ban be required or just encouraged? Do you think the president's order yesterday was a step in the right direction? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. James Holman is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the daily 202 newsletter. James, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, before we get to some of those breaking news stories, James, I want to talk to you about a piece out today. It's the fifth anniversary of the racist shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. You talked to Anthony Thompson, the husband of one of the victims of that shooting, Myra Coral Singleton Thompson. Can you share some of that story with us?
Yeah, it really is a sad anniversary. It's been 5 years now. Dylan Roof, a white supremacist, went into a Bible study where nine African Americans on a Wednesday night at a historically black church, beautiful church, were praying at the end of their Bible study. He killed them all, and he has been totally unrepentant. He said he would do it again. He's on death row right now. And, you know, we have these mass shootings, and then, you know, our attention understandably moves on. But for these families, they haven't moved on. But what listeners probably remember is that right after this shooting, 2 days later during a bond hearing, several of the relatives of the people who were murdered at this Bible study stood up and said that they forgave the shooter, kind of in the Christian tradition of forgiveness. And, you know, Dylan Roof, the shooter, has been unrepentant, but Anthony Thompson, who himself is a reverend, he was one of the people that day. He said kind of the words just came to him. And so he has spent the last couple of years trying to work on racial reconciliation. And so it was really interesting to talk to him just because, you know, one of the things that he says is this white supremacist who killed his wife, he wrote in an online screed that he hoped to trigger a race war, and that he hoped to divide the races by doing this. And so what Mr. Thompson says is, my mission is to make sure that he doesn't succeed. And so he's doing all he can to try and bring whites and African-Americans together in Charleston and South Carolina and around the country. And so really an inspiring story of someone who, you know, has just shown so much grace under such an extraordinary tragedy that for, you know, most of us is just unimaginable to have that happen to a spouse.
It's a powerful story. People can see that at the Washington Post website today. Moving on to the big political news of the week, James, President Trump signed this executive order on policing. What were the key elements that the White House included in the order?
It's a lot of guidelines. It's a lot of suggestions. It's encouraging local departments to follow best practices, to encourage more use of body cameras, but not anything really kind of required. And gives a lot of discretion to Attorney General Bill Barr. Notably, you know, the president surrounded himself as he signed the executive order with members of law enforcement, representatives of powerful police unions. So, you know, the Democrats on the Hill said it didn't go far enough. A lot of the activist groups, kind of the Black Lives Matter community, said it was just show, you know, just for show and doesn't really accomplish anything meaningful. On Capitol Hill today, Senate Republicans unveiled their big plan that they've been trying to negotiate, have Republican support for. They're going to need some Democratic support for it to be able to pass the Senate. Meanwhile, in the House today, Democrats had a committee hearing to mark up their proposal. So far, the House Democrats and Senate Republicans are kind of far apart. But one of the things that's been striking in my reporting today up on Capitol Hill is that there is a desire among Senate Republicans who are worried about losing their majority in November to get something done, to kind of put points on the board. And so there's right now the two sides are pretty far apart substantively, but in the last few hours, I've seen some appetite on the right. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, appeared at the press conference to unveil the draft bill today to at least kind of show that there's a real push to actually get this across the finish line.
Want to give a listen to the president speaking yesterday. He said he had met with families of victims of police killings. As you mentioned, he was joined at the signing ceremony by law enforcement officials. Here's a short listen.
What's needed now is not more stoking of fear and division. We need to bring law enforcement and communities closer together, not to drive them apart. Under the executive order I'm signing today, we will prioritize federal grants from the Department of Justice to police departments that seek independent credentialing, certifying that they meet high standards.
So the president's going with more carrot than stick here, it sounds like. Yeah. They'll give grants to departments that voluntarily do these things.
Exactly. And that's the key thing, is that, you know, when you talk to the activists who are out in the streets and the protesters, you know, we've now had like 17 straight nights of protests here in D.C. They say that there are these systemic problems that have to be addressed. And this does not kind of look for systemic changes. It looks for changes, you know, in encouraging people with carrots, as you say, that's absolutely right. But it's not, there's no overhaul of approach to law enforcement by any means.
Talking to James Holman from the Washington Post, looking at the big news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see coming from the president, from Congress, when it comes to police reform? If anything, do you think it should be up to state and local governments to deal with these issues? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's dig into what you mentioned, James, about Congress. What are the high points of what we're seeing so far from Senate Republicans?
Well, Senate Republicans are, you know, they really are looking to codify, you know, it's similar to the president's plan, but it goes a little bit further. The bill does not include a ban on chokeholds, even though there's a lot of support for that in a bipartisan way. The big hang up between the Senate plan and the House plan is getting rid of qualified immunity for police. The Supreme Court said on Monday that they're not going to take that issue up. A lot of House Democrats say it's their top priority, which is to make it easier for people who are abused, where an officer violates their civil rights, violates the law, to be able to take them or the department or the city to court. Democrats say that is a must-have. Republicans say it's a non-starter, and it is not in their legislation.
Talk a little more about the Democratic side of things. They're asserting more control, it seems like, over local police departments, or their bill would do that more than what we're seeing from Senate Republicans or the president. Is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a 175-page draft piece of legislation, and it really would impose a lot more federal control over local police and dictating what they can and can't do. That's absolutely correct.
You mentioned that there is some appetite for compromise, but it seems like some things are deal breakers for one side or another. Just based on what you're hearing so far, what specific parts of the proposals do you see both sides maybe heading toward agreement on?
I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up getting a consensus on chokehold ban, on some community policing, on some, you know, we'll definitely have kind of some commissions and stuff like that, but that's not what people are really looking for. You could see some reforms on the militarization of police departments. There are a lot of conservatives who, you know, think that the police departments shouldn't be getting weapons of war from the Pentagon and surplus. Tens of billions of dollars have gone out to local police departments, you know, including like rocket launchers, and we've seen a lot of these mine resistant anti-tank vehicles that are driving around in the streets. And so I think that there's some appetite on both sides to maybe scale that program a little bit back, and just generally trying to, you know, there's a lot of emphasis that both sides can agree on related to training, improving the quality of training and the training requirements for officers at the get-go. And also there's some conversation where I think you could see movement between the two sides on kind of accountability for all the officers involved. One of the issues in the Minneapolis incident was that there were these three officers who were sort of standing there watching what was happening, And one of the questions the courts are going to have to take up and a jury will take up, juries will take up, is how liable are those officers for not intervening? And so there's some discussion about adding kind of a duty to intervene into the federal statute. We'll see if that happens. That might be a more of a stretch.
We're talking to James Holman, national political correspondent at The Washington Post, looking at some of the week's biggest stories in national politics, including various police reform measures in the works. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there one element, one thing you would definitely like to change coming from Congress or the president when it comes to police reform? Or is there something you really oppose from what you just heard about, what's on the table there? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with James Holman, political correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the Daily 202 newsletter, looking at some of the big stories in national politics this week. James, before we move on from issues of police reform, let's go to a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to ask you, Gus, what would the role of public unions are in this, in these tragedies? I mean, the real question would be if the union is protecting police that probably shouldn't be on the force, and so many of the police are really trying so hard and doing a great job. Isn't it the unions that we need to take a look at? And that might even go for teachers. I mean, if the unions are protecting people who aren't doing a good job teaching, maybe it's time for us to re-examine public unions with people who don't have the chance to really be scrutinized in how they're doing their job.
Charlie, thanks so for the much. Call. James, I think I had seen in the news at least some Republicans in Congress have brought up the issue of union protections for police.
Well, it's interesting because this creates odd bedfellows and unique coalitions, because the police unions are incredibly powerful and they have negotiated into their bargaining agreements with cities that various protections, making it harder to get rid of cops who officers who have gotten in trouble or gotten, did basically limit discipline and create appeals processes, et cetera. You know, liberals, Democrats obviously tend to be very pro-union, and a lot of the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, defending police unions, but a lot of progressive leaders in Congress feel like police unions are this big obstacle to reform. And so there's some tension between the labor movement and kind of the Black Lives Matter movement within the Democratic Party over how much, to restrict union power. And, there's some Democrats on the Hill I've talked to who would love to say in federal law that certain things are not on the table in collective bargaining negotiations between cities and police unions related to officer discipline. And but the Republicans, this is a weird one, because Republicans are in some cases in Congress right now defending the power of the police unions, at the same time that generally they're not favorable to unions. It's also creating tension for someone like Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate, who has spent decades very close, very connected with police unions. They've endorsed him in all of his past campaigns. They endorsed the Obama-Biden reelection in 2012. But the police unions are angry at Biden because they say that he's not taken their side in the last few weeks. And then they view him as antagonistic. And it's kind of striking to go back and watch some videos from not that many years ago where Biden says basically that he let the police unions write his 1994 crime bill, and he invited them into his office and treated them as if they were his own staff in drafting the legislation. And so there's definitely kind of some tension within the Democratic Party on this one.
Let's take one more caller before we move on to all the other stuff going on in the nation's capital. Virginia is with us in Milwaukee. Virginia, hi. Virginia, are you there? Looks like she's not, but she wanted to bring up issues of police training. Are there any moves in Congress when it comes to bigger, better standards, growing standards for police training, James?
Yeah, there's definitely a desire to create some sort of national framework. Now, the question is, How specific should that framework be? What kind of requirements should there be? We obviously live in a federalist society, and there's a big desire to leave a lot of this up to states and local governments. And I think that there could be some kind of national training framework that grows out of this.
We're talking to James Homan from The Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Let's touch on a couple more. John Bolton, former national security advisor, longtime foreign policy hawk, now has this book probably coming out soon, a lawsuit from the Trump administration against him, not the publisher. And now things coming out. The book is in the hands of many media outlets. I don't know where to start on this one, James. Where do you want to start?
Well, I have my leaked copy sitting on my desk right here, and starting to work through it. So I think that they're not going to be able to put this genie back in the bottle. we've obtained it and reported. There's a lot of material. It's a meaty book. And Bolton is no love lost for pretty much anyone in the White House. The president certainly is not spared, but neither are a lot of others. The Attorney General, Bill Barr, takes a lot of criticism. Bolton details a lot of negative comments that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, privately made to him, allegedly, about the president's intellect and intelligence. One of the big takeaways, just based on my reading so far, I'm still really poring through this book, is Trump's, again, a lot of this, if you're following the news and foreign policy closely, not surprising, but Trump's affinity for authoritarians is really striking. Just his some of the most newsworthy material in the book is about Trump's private meetings with Xi Jinping, the leader of China. According to Bolton, at one point, Trump said, "I need your help getting reelected." He said that he didn't mind the Chinese having camps for the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority. He said that he has made positive and favorable comments about Xi extending his term so that he can be president for life. Xi apparently told Trump, "You have too many elections in the United States," and Trump said, "You're right. I wish I could serve more than two terms, and I wish I didn't have to run for re-election every 4 years." And Bolton saying that Trump did not appear to be joking during these conversations. And similarly, the president has had these kinds of conversations with, essentially dictators, from Kim Jong-un in North Korea to, al-Sisi in Egypt and Vladimir Putin in Russia and so forth. And, Bolton's a longtime national security hawk. He had top jobs in the last three Republican White Houses, including Reagan's. And Trump brought him into the fold. The Justice Department suggesting this afternoon, leaking out to reporters, that they're looking at criminal charges against Bolton for publishing this information. But it's hard to see any court upholding that kind of thing. And Bolton also saying that one of the striking things so far, as I've been reading through the book, is that Trump probably deserved impeachment for more than just the Ukraine imbroglio, that it was malpractice for Democrats to only impeach on Ukraine, he says, and that there were a whole lot of other things on foreign policy Trump did that could have been impeachable.
Well, one related story that you have followed over the last week has to do with North Korea and its nuclear program. The president had, this televised, highly publicized meeting with Kim Jong-un. Looked like prospects were there for negotiations and agreements. What's happened over this last week, though?
Yeah, so Bolton was there. Bolton writes about these three North Korean summits, essentially, that have been held. So we've been distracted. It's not just the last week. We've obviously, understandably, been paying attention to the coronavirus and the protests and the economy. But over the last several weeks, North Korea has been escalating tensions, kind of speaking a lot more negatively about the United States. And on Monday morning, Tuesday morning, they blew up this liaison office that they had opened in 2018. And there's no, because technically North and South Korea are still at war, they just have an armistice that ended the Korean War. This essentially has been functioning as sort of an embassy, and it's in the demilitarized zone. North Korea literally blew it up. And it's a metaphor for kind of blowing up the relationship. The North Koreans have done this before. They when they want something, when they want concessions, they tend to lash out and, act petulant. And it appears that they're doing that now. The maximum pressure campaign of sanctions has been working in the goal of kind of really shutting down the regime and its access to the outside world. But this is something, we're such a long way from that Singapore summit. That was only 2 years ago last week. And Trump declared that the North Koreans had agreed to give up all their nuclear weapons. They hadn't actually agreed to do that, but that's what the president said. And, 2 years later, the North Koreans actually have expanded their nuclear capacity. They haven't given up a single warhead, and they have, resumed missile testing last year. So it's not getting enough attention, but the North Korea threat remains quite real. And, they're still working behind the scenes to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles that are capable of hitting the West Coast.
Briefly, James, in our last 30 seconds or so much going on. What do you have your eye on next?
The coronavirus, we haven't really talked about much, but it is just so significant. And, with the numbers, I'm watching the numbers every day. President Trump is going ahead with his rally in Tulsa on Saturday. The indoor rally, the Republican mayor isn't going to stop it, but also says he's uncomfortable with it and isn't going to let anyone in his family go. Oklahoma is reporting record numbers of increases in cases. So that's sort of what I have my eye on now.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
We've been talking to James Holman, national political correspondent at The Washington Post, author there of the Daily 202 newsletter. He joined us for our look at the week's news from the nation's capital, including police reform measures from the White House and Congress. In just a few minutes, actually, we're going to dig more deeply into some of those police reform proposals, especially the one from the president.